nice to see you. Summer school is here. Even the weather has been quite nice so far. To me, this sounds a bit strange, but I hope that you are happy. Is it clear to you? The sound? Okay. Not used to using mics. Okay. So I was going to tell you a bit about methodological issues. So in hopefully less than 1 hour, cover some so-called advanced MET analysis topics and some novel brain-imaging approaches or brain neuromodulation approaches that I have observed people are using, not anything that I'm developing or using myself currently, at least not too much. You can, of course, discuss what is advanced MET analysis. It varies from person to person, of course. I would say that anything except evoked response analysis we can consider advanced MET analysis. So don't be afraid that it's something totally weird or too high-tech, anything. Okay. Here's the listing of topics for today. So first, a few analysis approaches. Some of them for sure are familiar to you. Then some other research methodologies. And the format today is just like brief reviews, not in-depth representations, not tutorials, not anything like that, but more like brief glimpses of what people are doing, what can be done. So I preferred having several items on the list as opposed to going deep on one or two subjects. And the reason that I'm doing this is that it's a very diverse field nowadays. Many different analysis approaches and sometimes even new imaging approaches. And even if you are not going to try them all out yourself, thank you. I'm happy with that. Even if you are not going to try out all these analysis approaches yourself, it's good to know them. On the other hand, because you are going to read a lot of papers where people are using this kind of methods. And maybe next time that you are planning your own study, you might remember that, okay, there are some options that I have. Would one of these maybe be suitable for my next study? Then you can already consider it when you are designing your future breakthrough papers. I think in the program my title was Future Methods, right? Well, I thought that I'm not able to talk too much about future methods to you. Maybe in future, let's see. But it reminded me of what are actually future methods? Where are they coming from? I've been on this field for something like 15 years, roughly speaking. And of course, there have been a lot of new methods and stuff around, especially in recent years. I started thinking, where are these methods coming from? And quite often they are, at least in hindsight, they are quite easily predictable. There are trends that are, for example, in some other fields of science. For example, talking of data analysis methods, they might have been used for data analysis of something completely different data, like weather data or whatever, or ecological analysis. And then if you talk about imaging methods, it's not like people on medical imaging very often at least come up with completely new physics and interactions with living matter or something like that, but they are existing technologies. For example, fMRI, MRI, we had the nuclear resonance business in chemistry and physics for a long time before somebody was able to apply it to human beings. Just to warn you that keep your eyes open, there are a lot of possibilities that are still not realized. And I'm curious to see in future what will be around. And I'm sure that if I understood correctly, you are going to graduate in year or two, so it might not hurt to stop for a minute at latest at that point to spend some time considering which kind of methods might be good to use in your next study, what is possible to do. Okay. I'm not going to scare you too much about this, but you know these experimental setups where you tell subjects that pay attention, we are going to ask you something about the stimuli in the end of the experiment. So now I use the same trick there. I planned some group work looming in the end of the presentation. Let's see how it goes. Okay, I start with my favorite topic. At least the local people, I've been talking about it, I think, already too much or quite often. It's connectivity, and especially functional connectivity. That's why I'm going to keep it short this time. It's somehow like spread lately all around neuroscience. Seems like in every lab there's somebody doing some kind of connectivity studies. And that's good. It has very good, solid idea and basis. The only downside is that the methodology is not very ripe yet. But we keep on trying, refining the methods, and then it will be good to apply for anybody. So what's the idea there? Okay, first of all, functional connectivity. It tries to... Why it's functional? It's like a separation to structural connectivity, of course. Structural connectivity means that some brain regions are physically wired together. Functional connectivity looks on the functional side. It's interested in brain regions that are firing together, so to say. So current understanding of the hypothesis of brain works is that we have a lot of integrative processing. It's not about single brain regions, anything like that. So we try to catch the integrative processing. Different brain regions have different capabilities, and how they work together, that determines output of the processing. I also mentioned parallel processing here, more like a distinction to integrative processing. With parallel processing, I mean that, for example, in the visual stream, even if you have a single stimulus, the processing of that stimulus is spread to, well, the most known is what and where pathways, or different specialized brain regions. They might not be catched with analysis of functional connectivity, because they are supposed to work kind of independently, right? So even if that takes place in parallel processing, takes place in several brain regions, it might not be a suitable tool for catching that. But integrative processing means that several brain regions work on the same processing task, and that's something that we can catch using functional connectivity methods. Okay, talking about humans, the main methods that we use currently for functional connectivity analysis is fMRI, the biggest one, and then we have MEG, and sometimes also EEG. Can I just, for curiosity, ask who uses MEG or is involved in studies using MEG in any way here? Okay, less than half, less than one third. Okay, thanks. That's mostly because with these methods, you can study, first of all, non-invasively humans, and you can get a whole brain view, right? If you are going to study connectivity, it doesn't help if you get an excellent view of a single brain region, right? That's why, for example, intracranial recordings are not so appealing quite often. How it works in principle is quite simple. You put electrodes or EMG sensors here, recording from different brain regions, and then you compare the two signals that you get. If there's something in common, then you think that those two brain regions are doing something like shared work. In practice, it's much more complicated here. And this picture also illustrates that most often with MEG and EEG, functional connectivity analysis is based on neuronal oscillations. That's what we most prominently see with those methods. With fMRI, on the other hand, it's completely different. You get a nice detailed view of hemodynamic activity all around the brain. But the signals, of course, look completely different compared to the electrophysiological methods. Here's one quite famous early study by Fox et al., where they had defined three regions of interest, the intraparietal sulcus, posterior cingulate, and medial prefrontal regions. And that's the raw data. You can immediately see that the PCC and MPF, they really go like hand in hand over a time scale of 5 minutes. And the parietal region goes like just the opposite. And this is where the so-called default mode network idea was originated. So you are measuring completely different things. The data looks completely different, but you are kind of doing the same thing with these two methods. Okay, that's a kind of same idea. How you actually do the analysis with MEG, EEG. So I mentioned that we are often interested in oscillations. But it's not often the raw trace or the filtered signal, but we divide it to amplitude and phase. Amplitude is nicely visualized here. The oscillation amplitude is the red curve. Here is the blue curve. In this case, you can see that they are almost identical, so there's a high amplitude correlation in those between those two brain regions. Okay. I go directly to the limitations, because without limitations, it would be too simple. So first of all, we have the spatial and temporal resolution problems. Spatial resolution is what we are lacking in MEG and EEG, and temporal resolution is what we are lacking in fMRI. fMRI, I mean, it's able to work fast enough if you consider the signal that it's measuring, but the signal is not directly a neuronal signal, so if you are interested in fast neuronal processes, like on the order of 100 milliseconds or something, that's something that it's very difficult to do that with fMRI. Then most often you have a limited view. So that's a different problem from resolution. Limited view, for example, in the case of MEG, it means that we are only able to see the cortex, the very superficial part of the brain, and even then, there are some parts in the cortex, like bottoms of the sulci and tops of the gyri, that we cannot very well see with MEG. So if the network nodes happen to be in outside of the field of view of our methodology, then we, of course, cannot reconstruct the network very well. Then what I feel that is a bit underrated in the field is the lack of neuronal hypotheses and models. We are able to do all kinds of calculations, correlations, so on. But is that really how what the brain is doing? I mean, if we see amplitude correlations between two regions, is it somehow significant for the brain? I don't know if it is, but I've been wondering that. Is this really the way that the brain, for example, transmits information between two brain regions? And regarding the hypothesis, if we are going to do hypothesis-driven research, we should have good educated guesses on which brain regions, when, how they are interacting. Quite often these studies are data-driven, so that you just compute everything that you can and you get a horrible amount of mixed results. Okay, experimental contrast artifacts, they can always be improved. Stationarity is more or less of a problem all the time. It means that if we are investigating the brain signal over time interval, there might be large changes within that time interval, which then are kind of neglected or averaged out. So we don't get a true picture at any time point, but a kind of average mixture of all time points. Then validation is one big problem as well. Keep it in mind when you read these papers. Here is a simulation I did some time ago for one paper. Here's a simulation of, you can identify it's a brain, right? It's a simulation where I have two sources in the cortex which are interacting. And in the left, there's almost no noise. It's a clear signal, accurate measurement, so on. And you can see that the correct connection between these two sources is printed in blue. I hope you can see it. It's correctly identified there. And the other extra connections, there are always a lot of connections detected with these methods, almost always. They are in the neighborhood, right? So they are almost correct. There's one correct and then many almost correct things. Here I have the same sources, a bit more added noise, some measurement errors, and what comes out? Lots of positive statistically significant connections. So I get these kind of results and then I go happily writing the paper, right? The ground truth is here, my results are here. Is there anything in common? I don't, at least I don't see that. But what we are lacking is a method to kind of be sure that what we are finding makes any sense. And that's like something I don't have any answers to give you, except that to do careful work all the time. Okay, from simple connectivity to more like causality issues. So apart from structural and functional connectivity, we are sometimes talking about effective connectivity. It means that activity in some brain region faithfully causes activity in some other brain region. This kind of causality studies can be done with transcranial magnetic stimulation, for example. But can it be done also with brain imaging methods? We can get estimates. My topic says, or headline says, causality estimates, right? Philosophically speaking, I don't think that we can get causality from imaging data, but we can try our best to estimate it. And all these causality estimates are based on lag-like correlation measures, not necessarily directly on signal lags, but something lag-like measures. And then we are free to interpret them how we like. the key issue in the interpretation of this kind of causality estimates is to remember the context. So there's always some kind of model that you build the estimates from, and then you need to interpret the results in that in the same framework. The field is currently dominated by grandeur causality estimates, but there are also some other approaches which in some respect might be at least as good. So about grandeur causality, or people sometimes talk about Gewerke causality if it's done in frequency domain. What you do is you build a model of a number of variables from the signals. And the model only uses the previous samples that you have. So you predict, the model that you build predicts the next samples based on the previous samples of all the signals. So it's a multivariate approach, which is great. Once you have built the model, you can compute different estimates for causality. So it's kind of built into the model that if the model works, then you are able to do causality estimates. Which signals affect which ones? There I named some. This model is directly linked to the definition of the Granger causality. Mr. Granger was an economist, and he built his model on some kind of market time series. They do a lot of nice time series analysis on the market side as well, if you want to have a look there. But the idea he had was that you try to predict these time series based on the history of the time series itself. So you predict the nth sample based on the n minus 1 previous samples. And if adding another signal, like x to the prediction model, gives a better prediction of the next sample of y, then we say that x Granger cause is y. Okay, so if x kind of brings some new information when you are trying to predict y, then x is called to be causally related to y. That's a nice definition. Causality is sometimes very difficult to define in the first place. What, I mean, might sound clear intuitively, but if you try to formalize it, it's not so simple. That's a nice way. I like that. The thing that, I mean, there are many nice studies done using this approach, but one problem that arose recently is that if you have some kind of modeling errors, like non-stationarity, noise, whatever, it very easily leaks from the model to the estimates, and it might make them next to useless. So some caution is required there as well. Can I make this any better somehow? Okay. Now you cannot hear me, right? Okay. Maybe I just messed it up. Another approach is based on something called delay embedding. So it's a completely different approach from that. How it works is that you try to model the time series by embedding it in a high-dimensional space with some delay. So take the signal and the delay, and then you kind of note down the history of the signals in M-dimensional phase space. The actual computations that are required to assess synchrony or causality from there, they are a bit more complicated. But it's the same idea that was used to discover the famous Lorentz attractor in chaotic dynamics. There is a good theoretical grounding for this as well, but not so much practical work yet. One interesting difference to this kind of Granger approach is that it can handle non-separable cases. So you remember I said that when you compare prediction of y with x present or not present, that requires that x can be a kind of single doubt, factored out from the model. That means that it's separable. If your case is not separable, you cannot do that. You cannot just take x away from the model. But you can do it using this kind of approach. So I hope that causality analysis is going to that direction. But as I said, it can be a tricky subject sometimes. For example, there's a famous causal model which predicts the abundance of some fish, was it sardine or something, based on the weather, the temperature, to be more accurate. And there the causality is quite clear. The temperature causes variations in the amount of fish, not the other way around, right? But it turns out that in this kind of non-separable cases, the amount of fish cannot be predicted from the weather data, but the other way it goes. So even if the weather causes changes in the amount of fish, you can infer weather from the amount of fish, not the other way around. It's somehow mind-boggling sometimes. Okay, so much about connectivity and causality estimates. Let's go to introducing another hot topic, at least on the MEG-EEG side of imaging data analysis, machine learning. I didn't really know how to what to write in the headline here, because it's somehow vague, wide field of study or concept. So it's called machine learning because it was originally meant to study how machines could learn, like how to build robots that, apart from being programmed for some task, could start learning by themselves. But now it has, of course, extended a lot outside of artificial intelligence field. So everybody's familiar with statistics, and you can see that there's something in common between statistics and machine learning. But what is there in common and what is different? That's not always so clear. So I had a few dividing lines here. So don't think that they are like somehow competitive fields or anything like that. They both have their places, but they come interestingly close to each other from completely different backgrounds. So one way to think is inference versus prediction from statistics. You quite often try to draw some clear inferences. Another thing, maybe a related approach, is model validation versus performance. So in statistics, you often have very rigorous, accurate, strict models. Then you try to infer if they are okay or not. In the machine learning field, you are more interested in how stuff performs, how the model performs. Just raw numbers. Or a bit similar lines, formalization versus engineering. This maybe reflects that statistics comes from mathematics, applied math or something. And machine learning is really like from engineering, very practical background. They often say that it's good as long as it works. Forget the assumptions and models and anything. What data shows, it's okay. There's an important division in machine learning, supervised and unsupervised learning. You might heard of this before, but with this dissociation you can already go a long way. So what separates supervised and unsupervised learning is if you have output data available. So input data can be considered being the same. For example, it can be your huge amount of brain imaging data. But when your algorithm tries to learn something from that, the crucial difference is if you have the output data. So what this can mean, I will take an example. For example, in unsupervised learning, independent component analysis can be considered as a form of unsupervised learning. So what it does, you just throw the data to the ICA algorithm, and it gives you out some nice components, right? So it only works on the input data. But in some machine learning approaches, you have output data available. It can be like a behavioral response. Then you can give that to teach your algorithm. You give the MET data, and then you say that, okay, with this kind of MET data, the behavioral response was like that. And then you have some other data, and the behavioral response was different. Then what your machine learning algorithm can learn is that why some data correspond to another behavioral outcome and the other data corresponds to the other behavioral outcome. So then you have supervised learning. You have kind of teaching signal present. Then it's also easy to measure the performance, how many correct classifications you get. I will more focus on supervised learning. As I mentioned, unsupervised learning is also intriguing. You can do ICAO, data clustering, whatever. But supervised learning is maybe more trendy now. Yeah. Okay, so there are many use cases. The most common might be classifier-based so-called decoding. I'm sure you have read this in many papers. We are decoding this and that from the data. You can decode the stimulus identity or some behavioral variable or the task or whatever. But what it actually does is, okay, you hear marketing speech like this. We revealed neuronal representations, something like that. But what it really does is, it compares pieces of data using some multivariate methods. Multivariate just means that you have like several channels in your measurement data. It's basically pattern comparison or pattern recognition, like in, for example, in machine vision, it's almost only pattern recognition. Kind of same thing is done here, comparing patterns. It might be topographies or temporal evolutions of signals or both. But that's at the heart of the stuff. So it's not decoding or seeing like neural presentations, of course, themselves, but it depends on what is the input data, what is the output data, how you teach it. All right. Here's a simple example of a machine learning method. It's some data that is being classified by an algorithm called support vector machine. So you have the data points here. And what this algorithm does is that it tries to find a line or a plane or a multidimensional whatever plane which maximally separates the two data sets. So this is supervised learning. You have told the algorithm that here you have red points and here you have blue points. And now it tries to find a plane that maximally separates those. Not very complicated, not very far away from like classical statistics. right. Just as in connectivity analysis, there are many things to consider when you are doing machine learning or decoding. Of course, method selection, it takes some expertise. You need to consider what kind of data you have, what is your aim in the study. Quite often it comes down to what algorithm do you have in hand. Did somebody code it for you already? But these different methods, of course, have different pros and cons, and it's a good idea to study a bit what are their relative merits. There's not one perfect solution that fits all. Then there's something called feature selection. Nowadays, there's a buzz about deep learning. You probably have heard of deep learning. In deep learning, you can trust the algorithm to find some interesting aspects from your data. But for this kind of supervised learning that we do, it's up to the user to consider which aspects of the data might be interesting or useful. You can do some transformations to your data, and it might be much better useful for the machine learning algorithm that you selected. And of course, remember, cleaning the data in any analysis methods is important to clean the data. The more complicated the method, the more important it is to have artifact-free, noise-free data. All right. Then there's a thing called cross-validation. Think of it as a divide and conquer. So in supervised learning, you teach the algorithm. You have the input data, and you tell what is the correct output. But you don't use all data at once. But you take the whole data sample, and you divide that somehow, use part of the data for teaching, and the rest of the data for testing. And then you might switch it around, like half and half, or in the other extreme, you might use leave one out algorithm, where you use all but one data sample for training and the remaining one sample for testing, and then all data points in turn are this one sample left out. The reason for this is that if you use all data for training, some models are very prone to overfitting. It means that it will not be a model for the phenomenon in general, but it's just an extremely well-fit model to your particular data. So the next time you would do the same experiment, the model wouldn't work at all because it's only reflecting the properties of the specific data points that you happen to have. So you don't want too good a fit. That might be a surprise, but it's an error. All right. Then one very interesting and potentially powerful approach in machine learning decoding is generalization. You can generalize the model that you found over conditions in your experiment or over time, over subjects, whatever. Please, you had a... Yes. Yes. Okay, right, I see. I think that, I mean, I mentioned this leave one out approach. I think that it has met some criticism that it's already prone to overfitting. It's like people defend it that you use as much of the data as possible to train it to get good results, but and you still have data for testing, but maybe this one sample is too little for testing it. So then again, if you don't have too much data, just splitting it in half might not be enough of data to train at all, right? So maybe between these two extremes is a good compromise. It depends, of course, on the details, but something like 1/4 of data sounds reasonable, 1/3 or something like that, yeah. So that you would use all data for training and then use the same data for testing. Yeah, that's when you are prone to get overfitting, right? So the testing data should be independent of the, as independent as possible of the training data. Thanks. Yes? Yes. Feature selection, yeah. I would again say that it depends on your study and which features in the data you are interested. It depends on your hypothesis. If you just think that the response amplitude changes, that's what you are interested in on your experimental manipulation, then you would just use the amplitude of the recorded signals, right? Or whatever your measure is, intensity, right? No, this is actually a like research field of its own almost, that how to select features. It also includes the number of features. So. Right? Okay. In the beginning, I said that in this field, people are quite often happy as long as it works, yeah. Right? So if I understood correctly, you first do something like a t-test to your data,
yeah.
And then you feed that. Yeah. Yeah, that's one way to select the features.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. To not keep it too theoretical or anything, I have one example for you here. It's from our study a few years back. Yeah. Published in Salty et al. In eLife. It's about a very interesting and controversial subject, like awareness. Or consciousness about visual stimuli. So I will briefly explain you how was the experiment done. Basically, you had this kind of stimulus in the front of the subject, and just briefly, these stars were removed, and there was a small dot in the place of one of those plus signs. And then the signs returned after 33 milliseconds as a mask. So this is a very difficult task. Subjects are not always able to say where that small dot was present or if it was present at all. Quite often, awareness studies are performed using this kind of threshold level stimuli, then you ask the subject, please press button A if you saw it and button B if you did not see it. But there are many shortcomings in this kind of approach. We try to overcome some of those with an experiment where awareness is content specific. So not only saying if you saw the stimulus, but also where was it? In which one of these 8 possible locations? And we had a few questions in mind. Maybe this is the one that best corresponds to the analysis. Is there a difference between neuronal coding of the same stimulus when the subject was aware or was not, did not indicate being aware of that? About the methodology, we used something called multi-class probabilistic support vector machine. Most often, SVMs are binary. It means that yes or no, red or blue, left or right. We had 2 classes. In multi-class, in this case, we had 8 classes. They correspond to the 8 locations here. And probabilistic, it means that it doesn't only indicate the best guess that the algorithm had, but it also gives a probability. It says that with 64% probability, this is the correct class. So we get a real number out of that. And this is a nice way to treat the multiple comparisons problem. We have all channels in one analysis. We have all the 8 locations in one analysis. Right. Here are the behavioral results. I think they are also interesting. So in trials where the subject said that they saw the small dot, the reported location was almost always the same as the real target location. So you see this nice diagonal pattern with almost ones and zeros. What is surprising is that in the trials where the subjects say that they didn't see the dot, they still perform quite well. So if the correct target location was 4, you can see that most of the answers were 4s, even if they say that I didn't have a clue where it is, but they are forced to guess, then they are more probably guessing correctly than incorrectly. If you have heard of blind sight, that's something similar. Okay, then to the actual decoding results. Here is the mean correct classification probability. So across all trials and conditions, how well is the multi-class probabilistic SVM doing its job? I think in this case we had either 1/4 or 1/3 division to training and testing trials. So in the baseline, we are at chance level, 1/8. And after a little less than 200 milliseconds, there's a sharp peak. So there is some information, some sign of the stimulus location in the brain signals, in the like evoked responses. Although it's done like trial by trial, not from averaged signals. Then the correct classification probability drops for a short while before peaking in the later processing stages. Now it looks quite nice, promising, but in this kind of studies you have to remember that it just uses all the information that there is in the data. And you cannot be sure what do we have there in the data. You could have, for example, a stimulation artifact of some kind, which is in the data. In this study, you could have eye movements. Eye movements are very well visible in MEG signals, and it would be very easy to decode eye movements. Well, we did do our best to eliminate that possibility, but in general, it's good to remember that. These algorithms just use all the data that you have, all the information that you have in the data. All right, there's another interesting division here. The early peak, the confusion matrix looks like that. So the confusion matrix means plot of actual location, predicted location by the algorithm, and then the probabilities. The color scale is here. So it looks like from the early peak, you can decode mainly if it was left or right. Right, you have the left block here and right block here. But within left and right, the locations are a bit mixed up with each other. Then in the later peak, you get nice, more diagonal results, mainly just mixing with neighboring locations. So you remember it was circular. You have highest probability on the correct position, but some mixing with the neighbors. No wonder. So here you have the same kind of results as here, but on the right you have it divided between conditions. And these conditions are aware correct, unaware correct, and unaware incorrect. We couldn't include aware incorrect trials here because there were just a few in the whole data set. But interestingly, you can see some differences. The early peak is almost the same in all categories, so independent of the behavioral outcome. They are kind of inseparable. But in the later stage, in the aware correct and also in the unaware correct condition, there's a lot of information present in the brain signals. There is some information about the location still in the later processing stages that can be decoded in the unaware false condition. But it's much less than in the two previous ones. Oops. Yeah. So that was the previous analysis was using all the channels. Then we changed the features a bit. We did minimum norm source modeling and used the source information as input to the decoder. And we also restricted the used data to regions of interest. So we picked a few, Calcarin, superior parietal, and middle frontal regions, and we wanted to see if there's any difference between these. The big picture shows that there are some differences in the early visual processing regions. The information peaks early, then it degrades, and in frontal regions where you should make the decision. Well, that was our hypothesis for the response. There's no location information present in the early stages, but it starts evolving rather late. The superior parietal, it has kind of both of these features, but you know MNE source modeling, it might be just spreading the signal from the other two regions. Our ROIs were quite large. But still some differences exist. All right, so those analyses were about evoked responses, but you can also use other features, like I mentioned. Our next question was that, do the neuronal oscillations have any information, especially do different frequency bands contain distinct information? Here, we are not decoding the location, but this is a decoding of the aware versus unaware, or aware correct versus unaware correct, right? So it would be a signature of so-called awareness or arousal or whatever. So it's basically the same stimuli, same methods, except that we pre-processed the data with wavelets and used only either the phase part here or the amplitude part. And then you run the same decoding analysis for each frequency band. These axes are a bit of a mess. Sorry about that. It's very early stage analysis, and it's individual subject only. But it's just to display that you can have some frequency-dependent information as well. On the amplitude side, it's the low frequencies that seem to have some information. Like typically, you have the evoked responses on this frequency range, right? But there's also something in beta-gamma band, very late. And here is the phase-based decoding. So you take the oscillatory signal and extract the phase and then put that to the algorithm. And you can see that there's something around maybe 9, 10 hertz in the alpha band. And then you have something in the gamma band as well. And interestingly, there's the early phase, early peak, and also a later peak, at least in this subject. At this stage, it looks interesting. I think I will skip this decode for connectivity stuff. Just mention that, I mean, the idea was to combine the two previous subjects, connectivity and decoding, to check if there's any information in the connectivity patterns. But I think I will skip them. You can ask me later about this if you're interested. You just give the estimated connectivity patterns to the algorithm. I still want to mention about the generalization of decoding. So from the same data, you can try to mine different information. For example, in this study, it depends on the teaching signal. You can decode stimulus position, top or bottom, the response of the subject, left or right, the correct response, left or right, and if the subject made an error or not. So it's not surprising that you can decode the stimulus position. It's not also very surprising that you can decode the actual response if it was given with left or right hand. Right. What is interesting here is that the required response, so the correct option, was also decodable, but only in the condition where subject saw the stimulus. In the unseen condition, you can again decode stimulus position, the response that was made, but there's no information about the correct response, and of course then not about the error that the subject would have made. So even from one experiment, same data, you can do many different kinds of analyses. And one interesting generalization is over time. This work by Jeremy King. So they have different kind of processing models, sequential processing here, reactivated processing, oscillating processing, whatever. And the idea is that you train decoder in each time instant. And what is common is that you train the decoder on one latency and then you test it on the same latency. But what is done here is you test each decoder on each latency as well. Then you see if there are some recurring patterns over the response period. And from this matrix plot, you can then deduce what kind of processing steps might have taken place. Here's one example of local global mismatch responses. You can see that they are clearly different depending on if the deviant was a local deviant or a global deviant. I will very shortly cover the representational similarity analysis approach. It's also a multivariate approach as the decoding stuff. It uses a bit different intermediate step, namely dissimilarity matrices. So the idea here is that, okay, you have some stimuli and some recorded brain patterns. The brain pattern is now just depicted by that kind of gray box array. And then you compare these response patterns, just compute a correlation between those. And then you get n by n, n is the number of trials, n by n array of how similar the response patterns are to each other. And then the great idea here is that you can compare this kind of similarity or dissimilarity matrices to some features in your stimuli, right? You can construct similar dissimilarity matrices for your stimuli. And the best thing is that it's always pairwise distances. You can choose what is your metric. So you can say that, okay, all green stimuli are similar. Or you can say that all living pictures are similar. It's up to you to define what is the metric. And then based on that metric, you get another similarity matrix. What you can then do is you compare those similarity matrices. This has been more done in fMRI, where you get very accurate mapping of the brain. But you can also do it with MET to ask when these effects take place. So what you can find is that at which brain regions those brain response similarity matrices correspond maximally to your defined distance metric, right? Like here, you have some model features extracted from the stimulus images, and you have the brain responses. From both, you compute the similarity matrices, and then you can see if the brain responses reflect the metric that you chose for the stimulus. That's a bit related to decoding, but a different approach. And I forgot to mention, it's very nice in the sense that you can use many different kinds of data, not only your brain imaging data, but also behavioral data, questionnaires, experimental parameters of any kind. In that sense, it's a very powerful approach. Then I was thinking of spending a lot of time on Bayesian thinking. The Bayesian thinking is a very general approach to statistics and modeling and data analysis and so on. But I will just keep to the basics this time. So at the core of Bayesian thinking is that, first of all, parameters and measurements, they are all random variables. So this kind of reflects the uncertainty, inaccuracy of your data and models. And as long as we are talking about hypothesis testing, the Bayesian way is kind of updating the beliefs based on the data. So the core equation is here. You have probabilities for different things, and what you have are H and E. H means the hypothesis, and E means the evidence. It's your measurement. So basically, it tells that the probability of your hypothesis, once you have the data, multiplied by the probability of the data, is equal to the probability of the evidence given the hypothesis times the probability of the hypothesis. So it's perfectly symmetric. All great math is beautiful and symmetric, not excluding this one. Usually you see it in this kind of formulation, because what we are interested in is this posterior probability of the hypothesis given the evidence. So once you have collected the data, what is the probability of a given hypothesis? And really, Bayesian equations, Bayesian thinking shows that it's just a matter of prior probability of the hypothesis times the probability that you would get the data that you have if your hypothesis is correct. The PE is more or less like a scaling factor. It doesn't change a lot. Let's have a short example. Medical diagnostics. So there's a person who goes to a doctor, and he has a fever. And the doctor thinks of three possible causes. For sure there are more, but for simplicity, it's a bad doctor. He only can imagine three possible causes for fever. Common cold, malaria, and cancer. Okay, we apply this Bayesian equation. The doctor remembers, I think I know this Bayesian approach. Now, the hypothesis corresponds to the cause of the disease, and evidence corresponds to the measurement. So the subject, the patient has fever. And now, of course, what is the correct diagnosis is the question. Okay. Let's start applying that. So what we are interested in is the probability of each of these hypotheses given the evidence. And what we need for that is the prior probability of the hypothesis before seeing any of the data, multiplied by the probability of having a fever once you have the hypothesis. Okay, first the prior probability. It's rather high for common cold, right? Common cold is quite common in the population. Maybe one of you has common cold. But at least here in Finland, malaria and cancer are luckily quite rare. So their prior probability is low. Okay, but how about this other term, other factor? Probability of the evidence given the hypothesis. It's high for common cold. It's even higher for malaria, right? If you know that, if you have malaria, for sure you have fever as well. That's what it reads. It's lower for the third option. You might have fever, but not often, at least not always. Now you multiply these together, pH and PEH, to get the posterior probability, the probability of your hypothesis being correct once you have the evidence. And about these options, the option one is the only one which ranks high for both of these factors. I didn't put the numbers in, but you could as well write there some representative numbers. So according to the Bayes rule, the most probable option is the common cold, because it's common in population, as the name says, and it most often causes some fever as well. What if the patient was in sub-Saharan Africa? What would change? Would that change or that one? Yeah, the prior probability would change, because in sub-Saharan Africa, malaria is quite common. So pH would be high. Well, not as high maybe as common cold, but higher anyway. This would not change. The probability of having a fever if you have malaria is as high in Finland as in Africa, right? Or anywhere. Then you just make a new calculations and give the diagnosis. Okay. I won't go into modeling this time, but remember that hypothesis testing is not the only thing that you can do with Bayesian approaches. You can do many things. For example, MEG source modeling about MME. The Bayesian interpretation is that your data, your sources, are having L2 prior. So they are normally normally distributed around zero with a known covariance matrix. And then the common well-known minimum norm solution is obtained as the maximum as a posteriori solution. And it's nicely very close to what we get from purely algorithmic, algebraic manipulations from regularized least squares analysis, which is, of course, good. You should arrive to the same destination independent of the route. Okay. So that's much for the analysis part. There's still small time window for going through the brain imaging stuff. I would like you to think a few questions for a minute, at least a half a minute. I understood that you all are doing some kind of brain imaging, right? But why? Don't say that somebody told you to do brain imaging, but maybe consider why. I mean, sometimes people try to answer questions that might be better used using some other methods than brain imaging. I'm not saying that this is the case in your case. I'm not even well aware what you are doing, but still, it's a relevant question. What are you trying to respond by doing brain imaging? And why are we doing brain imaging the way we do it currently? Well, I'm doing MET because we have the MET, right? I don't have an fMRI available. But is it the optimal way to do it? Is it the optimal way to study what you are interested in? Or how would you really like to do your research? I'm sure that no one is perfectly happy with your method of choice, but you could be. It's often good to be a bit critical, asking. It's a tricky question, why? You can always ask why. When my kids were small, they were asking like 1,000 times a day, why? I was very annoyed by that. Yeah. In the beginning, I mentioned that I had this experiment, remember? Please pay attention. There will be a test in the end. So I was visioning some group work around this theme, that what is the brain imaging method of our dreams and how would we use it? The idea is that you would not be restricted to any existing physics, any existing funding, anything like that. Just take your research question, your field of interest, and start thinking, what would I like to learn from the brain? And maybe even, well, once I have the information, what would I do with that? You can include the analysis part as well. You can then consider if it's possible in this world or not, but I think that, yeah, about these aims, clarify to yourself, what is it that you are doing now and why? What is it that you would really need or like to do? What kind of brain research? And imagine, could it be possible? I think this is a good way of kind of sharpening the idea that you are going to do. Okay, if you are graduating in 1 year or something, then maybe postpone it to the post-grad part, but anyway, I hope you got the idea. Now we will forget about the group work. You can do that in the evening, because I used all too much time ranting about the analysis methods. Just a quick check to few, not strictly speaking, brain imaging methods, but many of these are like brain modulation approaches, which I think are at least as interesting methods to study how the brain works. And I excluded all the familiar ones like MEG, EEG, MRI, fMRI, PET, whatever you have. I tried to find something that you are not yet maybe familiar with. So first of all, you probably knew that ultrasound can be used to probe human tissues. For example, if you are pregnant, then you often go to ultrasound examination to check what is happening in the belly. But what you might have not known is that you can do some brain modulation with ultrasound. It's then called low-intensity focused ultrasound. Why we want to emphasize the low-intensity part is that you can also do high-intensity focused ultrasound, but that has some more drastic effects. For example, it has experimentally been used to treat Parkinsonian by destroying some of these malfunctioning tissues. So then it's called ablation. But if you go from higher to lower intensities, you might get reversible effects. So then you are able to increase brain activity in very sharply defined part of the brain. And that has been used to induce tactile sensations, modulate erect responses, and for some reason it works especially well in anesthesia. We don't know yet why. So it's basically a neuromodulatory technique. And it's based on the fact that ultrasound can penetrate tissues. Here you have a map of what kind of sound frequencies go how deep in the tissue. Luckily, human hearing level is well below that one. Okay, then there's my favorite subject. I never used it, but it was maybe the method of my dreams long time ago before it came reality. Some really nice work has been done doing that, and I think that it will bring a Nobel Prize someday. So if you are not familiar with that, I'll just briefly explain what's optogenetics about. So it's based on some light-sensitive proteins, which are called opsins, which can be found in nature, like in the algae, and quite homological proteins are also in the retina. And there are currently many, many different ones, but the original ones were these guys. So they are light-sensitive proteins. What they do is that they let ions pass when they are exposed to light. And they have different wavelengths. For this channel rhodopsin, it lets ions pass when it gets blue light. And then there's this kind of pump, which is activated by yellow light. So they are different wavelengths. And here's a short experimental manipulation showing that when you flash blue light, you get neuronal activation. And when you have yellow light, it suppresses activity. Okay, but this kind of integral proteins are not something that everybody would have in your brain. You need some viral vectors, so viruses, to bring these proteins there in the tissue. You just inject them, and then the cells are labeled with those proteins, and they will start building the channels on the cell membrane. And what is extremely cool is that you can have cell type specific promoters. So then you basically can have a patch of cortex expressing this kind of proteins on the cell membrane, with the result that when you give blue or yellow light, you excite or suppress neuronal activity. And light can be, of course, very precisely controlled location wavelength timing, everything. Here's one nice paper from almost 10 years back where you had a fast spiking interneurons or regular spiking principal neurons labeled with different opsins, and the stimulation frequency was varied, and turned out that principal neurons tend to fire at low frequencies, for example, and interneurons at high gamma frequencies. At the time, that was major confirmation to many, many models' ideas. But of course, this field is also going forwards. Just recently, there was a paper where this was taken to the next level. So they had new proteins showing faster, more accurate kinetics and so on, and new optical arrangements where you are able to produce very accurately defined 3D patterns of light. So you can actually, what they say, manipulate the neural code. So you can select very precisely, this shows how precisely, you can select the neurons to modulate. And if you do simultaneous calcium imaging, you can really see that the stimulation is manipulating the target structures just like as was wished for. So with these tools, you can generate almost any kind of neuronal activity patterns and see how they change the behavior of the animal. Okay, one more conventional thing is near-infrared spectroscopy. It's based on having light sources and light detectors, basically optical fibers on the scalp. And then you send infrared or near-infrared light, which passes through tissue. So just scatters around, comes from the source, scatters around, and escapes from the detector. So most of the tissue is transparent. Water and fat, of course, are always present. They absorb a bit. Then there's melanin, which also absorbs a bit of those of that light. But what is interesting in brain research point of view is hemoglobin. And the state of the hemoglobin affects its absorption properties. And if you think of fMRI blood signal, that's also based on the oxygenation level of hemoglobin. So you can get similar information using this near-infrared imaging as fMRI. Not completely the same, but you understand the source of the signal. The optical window, the picture is quite small, but between roughly 600 and 900 nanometers wavelength. And there you have, for example, here, a clear separation between oxygenized and deoxygenized hemoglobin. And you can use several wavelengths to get more information on what are the relative concentrations of these two kinds of hemoglobins. Then when the brain region activates, there's increase of oxygenated hemoglobin quite soon. And you can see that. Spatial resolution is not even close to fMRI, and you cannot see deep structures. But the temporal resolution is better than with fMRI. And it's an evolving method. But I wanted to present this one because the title said that it's brain imaging methods from the future. So I needed to find something from the future as well. It's called currently open water. It really sounds science fiction to me. And in the web pages, they didn't even have a very accurate description of what they are doing. But I will try to explain you the idea that I got. It looks like the company is run by people who are like hardcore scientists. engineers, which of course makes it a bit more credible. But the whole idea is so incredible that I don't know how to think of this. So this is also based on infrared light. And the premises are that, as we saw, infrared light penetrates tissue. And on the other hand, it has been known for a long time that laser light can be used to produce holograms. You have some kind of an idea what is a hologram. It's like a 3D view of an object. And the hologram contains the same information as the target. Usually it's a 3D structure. So these guys are going to use infrared lasers to produce a hologram of the brain. And not only the structure, but because of this dependency on the oxygenated hemoglobin and deoxygenated hemoglobin, they are going to produce a functional hologram of the brain. And they even say that they have a trick to de-blur the image so that they would get a crisp image of the whole brain volume. Sounds too good to be true, but it remains to be seen. Just, I know that I'm exceeding my time with a couple of minutes, but just briefly describing how to make holograms conventionally. This is not the brain hologram, but just a conventional way of doing them. So you have a coherent light beam, a laser, which goes through a beam splitter. So part of the original light hits the object of study. Part of the original light goes to another route, the mirror. Now, the light reflected from the object has some information about the object, of course. And this original reflected light is called the reference beam. And when, so without the object, these two routes would be the same. But now the object creates some like disturbances to the beam. And the interaction pattern of these two beams creates a kind of pattern on the photographic plate, what is actually now the hologram. And now the interference pattern contains information about the reflections from the object. And how you then reconstruct the information, you give the same beam, the reconstruction beam, to this plate where you have the interaction pattern, and then the interaction pattern generates a virtual image of the original object. You can maybe try picturing this as like dropping two objects to water and observing the interaction patterns, interference of the water fronts, whatever. Okay, this is something that has been done a long time ago, but the functional hologram of the brain, we are looking forward to that. There are for sure some problems, like the technology, the optics, the light sources, whatever. Penetration of the light, tissue movement. When you do holograms, the stuff cannot move at all, otherwise it's completely spoiled. And I don't know how they are going to stop tissue movement. Maybe they have a trick. And also, if you are putting a lot of this infrared power to the tissue, then your head is going to heat quite considerably. But remains to be seen. Looks like they got decent funding anyway. Okay. That's it. Thank you for being so attentive. I think my experimental manipulation worked. Any observations, questions? No, you're ready for lunch. Yeah, I see. Yes. Thank you.